Welcome to The Difference Engine, the show for founders, funders, and tech innovators. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Jonathan.
What are we going to talk about this week?
So this time, we'll have an intimate look at Tory flasher William Ragg and the political Luddites.
We'll turn away from tech and look at art for a lesson in category design.
Say goodbye to the bag and hello to James Dyson. What can we learn from this leading category designer? But first of all, we're going to start with a quote from NVIDIA founder Jensen Huang. And warning, this one is going to hurt.
To this day, I use the phrase pain and suffering inside our company with great glee. Boy, this is going to cause a lot of pain and suffering. And I mean that in a happy way, because you want to refine the character of your company. Greatness comes from character, and character is informed out of smart people. It's formed out of people who suffered. If I could wish upon you, I don't know how to do it. For all of you Stanford students, I wish upon you ample doses of pain and suffering.
Jensen Huang's Stanford address has been all over the news. You might say, who the hell is Jensen Huang? Well, Jensen Huang is the CEO and co-founder, along with a couple of other guys, of NVIDIA. He's the man of the moment. He's the CEO with the highest employee approval ever in a market that can't get enough of his GPUs and a share price that goes ever upwards.
So guess what? We've got another amazing overnight success. Well, no, we actually haven't. He's been trying to be the amazing overnight success for the last 30 years. And for any of us who have ever built a company, they know that no matter how shiny you look at the end, you'll have had some failures and some, frankly, near-death moments.
Yes, he admits that. On the Acquired podcast, shout out to Ben Gilbert and Dave Rosenthal, Jensen talks about the company literally, and I quote, running out of time, running out of money, and for many employees, running out of hope. These guys, they just go on, roll the dice with one last product. So the man of the moment jumping the shark versus capturing the zeitgeist. We might want to explain what we mean by jumping the geist.
Jumping the geist, you mean jumping the shark? It's said that this idea was coined by a guy called John Hine, who actually has a website called jumptheshark.com.
Hey.
Yeah, well, that's very fond for those of you who are old enough to remember that lovely little show, Happy Days, based in Milwaukee, sunny days only in the 50s. Anyway, enough of that. There was an episode in Happy Days where one of the main characters, who was a motor mechanic of Italian extraction called Arthur Fonzarelli, jumps over a shark on water skis, which Hine believes was the point at which the series lost its touch and was beginning to grasp at straws. So Jump the Shark is basically an inflection point, and the inflection is about going downwards.
And Jensen's inflection is about going the other way. It's about when the time is right, when you've really got to put the hammer to the metal.
Yes.
So why did the hallowed halls of Stanford bring in Jensen Huang to talk about them? What have they got to learn?
Huang is from a golden age of tech entrepreneurs. You know, certainly before what we've talked about in recent episodes, the tech tourists started to arrive and tech became the favorite destination of get-rich-quick merchants and frankly, grifters. Our view is that tech succeeded because it was led by outsiders who wouldn't or couldn't join the establishment. They had to go through pain and suffering. You know, undoubtedly, we saw over the last decades, you know, people who were neurodiverse, maybe just plain hyper-intelligent, but impossibly nerdy. And for them, tech provided a sanctuary for their skills. That's definitely so, but I think all the evidence is it was the ultimate outsider class, people with nothing to lose, you know, immigrants to other countries, or frankly, the children of those immigrants who were actually driving force
there's a long
for
list,
innovation
right? Which
and category design. I think America and certainly the West Coast, you know, there's a fine heritage of outsiders and all the pain and suffering they experienced before they even got into the tech environment. So you look at guys like Peter Thiel, a German working in America and a gay German to boot. Got Larry Ellison, a Jewish immigrant named after Ellis Island, but an orphan. Sergey Brin, Larry Page of Google, you know, Russians escaping the confines of communism. Steve Jobs, Syrian immigrant parents and adopted. You know, look at the UK. Herman Hauser, one of our greatest tech entrepreneurs, Britain's favourite Austrian. And of course, Mustafa Suleiman, of Turkish heritage, but a Brit, heading Microsoft's AI effort now. Yeah, the list really does go on.
It's too much of a coincidence that all of these guys have suffered pain and suffering and become category leaders. Yeah, we want to talk about resilience. And I think in episode 16, we had the CEO of ProductsUp, Vincent, telling us all about how his lessons of resilience in building a category have helped him to get to where he's got today. I mean,
hey, he's a Dutch guy living in Germany too.
Another immigrant. And, you know, this seems to be the theme, and there's more to this than I think most people give it credence for. I mean, it's great if you're a Stanford or a Harvard grad, you know, a mid-stage or late-stage company where you need that managerial oversight, obeying the rules, climbing up the greasy pole, looking at analytical models. You know, that's fabulous MBA-type stuff, but it's not really what you need for category design. You need a whole different set of attributes, right?
Yeah, yeah. Outsiders are willing to take risks.
And I think even more so today, in today's VC market, in normal times, 25 to 30% of VC-backed startups fail. That's normal times. Let's look at where we are now. We're in the ZIRP era, the zero interest rate period. You know, you see the folks that maybe weren't so resilient.
Well, Hopin, for instance.
Yes.
You know, I mean, for those not familiar with it, UK online events business, very, very sexy for a few weeks around COVID, which folded after being valued at about $7.75 billion, I seem to remember.
Yeah.
Founder did trouser a few million, but
I believe so.
I'm sure some of those employees are still unemployed and really reaching deep into their well of resilience.
PitchBook is calling this current period that the investment is at its lowest quarterly value since 2017. So why on earth, as an employee or a category leader, would you put yourself in for the uncertainty, the stress, the no money? I mean, how do you do that? What's the motivation?
Oh, can I mention Nietzsche now, please?
Okay, if you must.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
I say, tell that to a war refugee. I think that's a very overused quote, and the man was a very miserable individual in the latter period of his life.
So perhaps Nassim Taleb's got a bit of a better grip on this.
Well, we like Nassim. We loved Black Swan.
Yeah.
And his book, kindly reminded to us by our producer Seb, Anti-Fragile, has a very interesting subtitle: Things That Gain From Disorder.
The pain is going to come, and you can't avoid it. You have to embrace it.
That's right. Our lessons are from Jensen and from our own experience with category leaders, Vincent and others. Experience and resilience will trump the MBA book work. And I think that's what Jensen was trying to tell us with his pain and suffering speech. Nothing worth achieving was ever easy.
Think there are too many lookalike tech companies chasing the same markets? We do. We think it's because so few tech startups are able to build and lead their own categories. What matters most is to be different. Stop following and start building your own unassailable leadership position today. Working with the category design gurus at Categorical brings decades of differentiation expertise to your team. Book a consultation from our website today, and we will send you our one-pager detailing how to start designing your own highly differentiated category.
Next up, they say no two category leaders are quite the same. And as we've discussed, the Taiwanese-born CEO of NVIDIA wished every fortunate student pain and suffering. He called it his superpower.
Now, can you imagine a category leader from a very, very different life? Privileged background in the heart of the West. Could they ever hope to create a category? You know, imagine a guy absolutely unlike Jensen Huang, who's seen no poverty, whose parents are part of the establishment, who was not self-educated, and in fact benefited from a very nice private education.
Who could this be?
Give you a guess. He's now a knight.
Paul McCartney.
No, not Paul McCartney. In fact, I give you Sir James Dyson. Now, why should this scion of the establishment seek out the pain and suffering he clearly has done? Who would do that?
Let's have a look at the ultimate tech category creator. Let's have a look at James Dyson. He started off with the ball barrow. Look it up if you don't know what that is. It's a wheelbarrow with a hoppy ball, space hopper on the front, essentially.
Clues in the name.
Didn't get it right first time. He did 5,000 prototypes. I did a quick search on Amazon for a ball barrow, and the closest thing I could find, I think it was the brand was Walsall wheelbarrows.
Yes,
£160 will buy you something that isn't even as good as the original ball barrow. I think he was right to move on from the ball barrow and think about cyclones.
He decided he wanted some more pain, didn't he? So presumably influenced by some look at minerals processing, he realised that a cyclone might be the best way to separate the dust and muck we all collect in our houses and our gardens, you know, in our whole domestic establishment, and much better than separating than a piece of perforated paper.
And when he was interviewed back in 2007 in Fast Company, he talked about the importance of failure in one's life. So there is a connection with Jensen there. And he said, I made 5,127 prototypes of my vacuum before I got it right. There were 5,126 failures, but I learned from each one.
The big breakthrough, in retrospect, of course, is the cyclone-driven vacuum cleaner. I nearly said Hoover there, but that's a very interesting thing. It's because if you become an early category leader, you do become the generic. Anyway, the idea of using mineral processing derived technology to separate out household dust, although it seems genius in retrospect, did not penetrate the market very easily. In fact, Dyson had to move to Japan in the belief that he'd be working in a much more innovative society to start launching this particular technology.
And this was despite having a very, very catchy tagline, which was anti-Hoover, obviously, which was, say goodbye to the bag. He really needed the technology and the marketing to come together, and it seems to be working pretty well. He's now got hair dryers, fans, hand dryers, sadly, not the car. We were really hoping for the car. That didn't come.
Yeah, but they are, you know, they're pumping a lot of money into R&D. And we have in the UK, there's an ongoing argument about how little we actually invest in manufacturing and the economy. And Dyson appears to be doing it single-handedly. It's pumping £9 million a week into R&D. That's up 40% on 2023. And crucially, he's not looking at what he's doing now. He's looking right to the future, looking at AI, robotics, next-generation batteries, and software. And he's globalized his R&D, but with research hubs, UK, Singapore, Malaysia, Philippines, anybody would think he was doing a 24-hour follow the sun model. They've now hit global revenues, $7.1 billion, for a domestic product manufacturing company. That isn't too shabby. That was 2023, up 9% on the year. And they're gearing up for their biggest line of product launches to date. But this is backed by 6,500 engineers, which is prodigious for any UK company. And the thing we really like about it is Dyson is sticking to his knitting. He's still the chief engineer and expect new products in beauty technology, home technology, and even wearables, where he's clearly going to drive some innovation.
I think you can tell we're big fans of the guy, and the boy is still at it. He is still innovating in categories, experimenting like crazy. You talked about noise cancelling, air purifying headphones.
Oh, God, talk about bringing two categories together.
And what you're doing there, of course, is reframing the art of the possible, reframing the category, shaping the future that you want. It's just complete category design.
Reframing what consumers should expect from everything from the actual application of the appliance to the quality by which it's made. But I've just got one little bit of a problem with Dyson. I'm really glad that Dyson is keeping the role of chief engineer, but that means that somebody else has really got to run the company. So a few months ago, they appointed Hanno Kerner as the new chief exec. He's ex-Jaguar Land Rover Group and BMW. Ironically, the decision to appoint Kerner came after that they scrapped their attempt to build the electric car after getting rid of £500 million in that event. What worries me is that Kerner is clearly an established king of better. Everything he's ever done is about making an existing product better. Presumably succeeded at BMW, perhaps didn't do it at JLR. If we're not careful, there could be an abandonment of Dyson's guiding principles around innovation. And just as well, the emperor of different, Dyson himself, has all the shares.
Yes, and I have a little bit of beef with James myself. He met with the Chancellor, Mr. Hunt. This was ostensibly about R&D investments. It is reported in the Telegraph, I believe, that there was a bit of a spat there, and the politician told the category designer to stick to designing and being an entrepreneur, and if he wanted to affect politics, to get himself elected. Bit rude.
He probably isn't a serial grifter, so he probably wasn't going to take that offer up. But I think what is really interesting about this is, you know, this is Huang's pain and suffering for category creators.
So we're going back to Jensen.
Yeah, back to Jensen. Car brand as well, of course, for those of you who know the little Brummy firm that used large American V8s to make sports cars.
We digress.
Cars.
Pain and suffering.
You know, the US version seems to mean immigrant families, early life poverty, work ethic beyond the native citizen. But others like Dyson have deliberately put themselves into situations of pain and suffering where they could have had much more comfortable alternatives. And, you know, that tells you a lot about personal motivation.
So what we're saying is that somebody who did not have to put themselves into a world of pain and suffering seems to have achieved greatness as a result of it.
Absolutely, but they have to be prepared to do it. So hats off to Dyson. In the great race to be the world's favorite entrepreneur, somebody who didn't have to do it has triumphed. And sometimes you may think that takes even more gumption that somebody had no choice.
Greater than Jensen.
I think it probably does.
I think we could have them both round to dinner and have a very good debate about that.
Okay, so leather jackets on. Let's have Jensen and James round for dinner.
It's a plan.
You know what? This really grinds my gears.
Conservative MP William Ragg confessed to leaking fellow MPs' contact details after being lured into a honey trap sexting scandal.
Ragg admits he was mortified and apologised for his weakness after claiming the man had compromising things against him.
Why is it that politicians cannot keep it in their pants? Mm. Or, if they really, really cannot, at least avoid pointing your iPhone at your pecker.
Surely not. I mean, it defies description, this, isn't it?
It defies belief, actually.
It's sort of the latest. I've lost my phone, so I cannot give you my WhatsApp messages. Didn't Nicola Sturgeon, the cocky and self-proclaimed plain-speaking Scottish former
minister... Well, there was nothing
minister,
plain-speaking about when she lost her WhatsApps.
Yeah, she became very silent, didn't she? And sort of quite nippet, as my Scottish mother would have said. And what about bumbling Boris? My God, he was very good at losing his WhatsApp messages.
Well,
he
was advised to change phones, to be fair.
Of course. Oh, yes. It was his,
believe that.
It was my advisors.
Even our beloved leader, Mr. Sunak, didn't have him ready to show.
We could go to jail if we tried that trick.
Oh, my God. We would be in jail. This is what's so annoying. And the fact that his mates from the same political party tried to excuse him and say it's well done for apologising, I mean, that just doesn't even touch the side. Like you say, we'd be facing jail time. I don't think that's beyond the pale here. Why is it our politicians are so far behind on tech? Once it was sort of sweet, right? Okay, I don't really get tech. You know, everyone could go off and innovate. We had a great old time. But now everybody uses tech, including them. And I don't understand why it's acceptable to apologize for what is essentially a national security issue.
Yeah, well, let's face it. Our politicians are essentially a political class. They exist on their own and they exist away from normal society.
I mean, they're tech simpletons, right?
Okay, so, we have somebody, as you said, called Rishi Sunak, who happens to be our Prime Minister at the moment, and not for much longer, most people believe. But in his time remaining, what do you think Rishi should do?
Well, I think he should consider what we know. So we know that Meta, who owns WhatsApp, works very closely with the US government. And we know, thanks to the absolutely atrocious Online Safety Act, which was the Online Safety Bill, that there's backdoors being engineered into these messaging apps. In what world does it make sense for those guys who are having confidential national security-based issues to be going around with this sort of behavior? If I was Sunak, here's what I'd do. Number one, I'd sack the tow rag immediately. Sod the election.
Very Freudian.
Very Freudian. Contact everybody that's been involved in this. And I mean all the SPADs should be contacted and they should be warned. And I hate to use this phrase, but re-educated on what exactly they can and cannot do safely. And a little bit of education on cyber hygiene.
But surely also you'll be fired immediately if you do any of these things.
Let's not get into public decency, but it's atrocious behavior. And then I think, and possibly most controversially of all, I would just ban WhatsApp as a vehicle for anybody in government to be using to message, and maybe go with something nicely secure, something with you know, encryption engineered in from the start, such as the nice British app Element, based on the open source Matrix platform, but something nice and British, and avoid all of these pants down scenarios.
Problem solved.
Problem solved. So what next? What are we going to talk about in tech next, Jonathan?
I don't want to talk about tech. I want to talk about art.
What about art?
We constantly talk about category just in terms of technology. I mean, that's fine. That's fine. We know technology has changed the world, you know, from flint axes to antler picks onwards. But categorization too has been changing the world for centuries in different ways. And there are lessons here for current times. Why did I get onto this? Well, I've always, as a Brit, had a soft spot for the Impressionists. The rise of Impressionism, I think, was a perfect category play. Right, let me explain why. First, the Impressionists passed the first rule of category.
Different, not better.
Be different, not better. So everybody from Gustave Caillebeau, Mary Cassatt, Claude Monet, Berthe Morisot, Renoir, Sisley, they were an eclectic bunch, but they had one thing in common. Their style of painting was different, right? They broke all the conventional rules of painting in France at the time they were around, you know, And there were conventional rules because it was controlled with an iron hand by the Académie des Beaux-Arts. And the Salon, which was the exhibition, they organized yearly in Paris. Now, this was an incredible thing because they decided how painters should paint. A very, very prescriptive style, looking back to ancient times.
You're reminding me of big tech telling you how to run your products and run the world.
Sort of like that. But the problem was it was holding back a whole cultural movement. So if you didn't exhibit at the Salon, you weren't considered a serious artist. Dealers weren't interested in you. No, it would never fetch the sort of money that would allow you to make an independent living.
How do you modernize that?
Well, the Impressionists did the second rule of category, which was to break all the rules. You know, their art didn't depict classical scenes. They replaced intricate portraiture with wild brushstrokes, you know, modern scenes. There's no attempt to disguise the artist's hands. They constructed their paintings from big colours and brushstrokes and realistic scenes, modern life, painted outdoors, you know, that was it. The third rule of category, as we've talked about with Jensen Huang in particular recently, was that they were a bunch of outsiders. They wanted to design a new category, even though they probably didn't realise they were doing it at the time, because in the 1860s, they kept putting their painting into the Salon, and guess what? The status quo rejected them. They couldn't get a break.
You know, this is what happens early in any category. You sort of don't get that first hint of success until something small begins to turn.
Exactly. And you know, the something small in this case came from the Emperor Napoleon III, who for some reason didn't like what was going on in the Salon. And he said, the public should be allowed to judge the artwork for themselves. So they set up a thing, which I love this, the Salon des Refusés, the Salon of the Refused.
Nice.
So guess what happens? Remember we were talking about what happens when you start to move a category forward? People try and take you down. Lots of people came out of curiosity, and actually the early Impressionist salons got more visitors than existing salons.
In our language, in the category world, would that be regarded as a strike?
I would say it was a strike. So they struck. Because they'd struck, the fuse had been lit and they couldn't afford for it to go out. The Impressionists had seen a chink of light, so they petitioned for a new Salon des Refusés in 1867 and again in 72, and they were denied. However, they weren't going to let go. They had resilience. In December 1873, Monet, Renoir, Pizarro, Sissy, César founded the Société Anonyme Cooperative des Artistes, Peintures, Sculptures et Graveurs.
Right, so hold on, I got terrible French, but I'm going to say something like the Anonymous Cooperative of Painters, Sculptures and, I don't know, Engravers.
Yeah, Company of Painters, Sculptors and Engravers. And what were they going to do with this? They were going to exhibit their artworks independently.
Strike two.
Strike two. And they were serious about it. If you join our club, you will not exhibit with the Salon. I.e. don't consider there is competition and certainly don't go and join it.
Brand new ecosystem.
So as soon as they did this, mixed response. Monet and Cezanne got absolutely slated, but they kept going. despite the fact that they didn't make any money from their exhibitions. They were building an ecosystem around here, particularly the route to market.
So route to market in this case being dealers, right?
Yeah, yeah, Durand Ruel. He just kept showing their work to the public.
This is fascinating because these days you would never think they encountered an issue in their life. I mean, they're very much what people regard as art.
Their great success in establishing the category was that they'd achieved the seventh rule of category, which was that of acceptance. And we know by the end of the 20th century, the Impressionists are still massively important and had weathered, you know, the many forms of modernism and classical revival that had tried to knock them off their pedestal. And they're still the most popular art movement of all time. And this is because they followed a classical category creation track. Categorization has been changing the world for centuries in different ways. The classic phrase here applies, those that don't know the history are doomed to repeat it.
Do let us know if any of this strikes a chord with you. Look forward to speaking to you next time. Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more, go check our blog posts on becategorical.com.
If you have a category issue, then we can help. Get in touch with us.
And remember, don't be better, be different.